Number 21-1579, Johnson v. Department of the Air Force. Ms. Martinez, please begin when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the Court. I'd like to thank the Court for the opportunity to present this appeal today for Jacob Johnson from an arbitrator's decision to uphold the Air Force's decision to remove him from his federal employment as a firefighter at Dyess Air Force Base, based upon a sole charge that he tested positive for oxycodone, oxymorphone, without a valid medical reason. Today, I'm going to focus my argument on the agency's substantive and procedural due process violations, then also the agency's failure to follow its own procedures, failure to properly apply the Douglas factors, and also failure to demonstrate that there was a nexus between his off-duty conduct and his ability to complete the agency mission. First and foremost, Mr. Johnson is a civil servant and a federal employee, so he has a property interest in his continued employment as a federal employee, and can't just be dismissed except for just cause pursuant to 5 U.S.C. 7512.
Right. Since there are a number of things going on, can I just focus you at least what I come into the argument focusing on is the argument about ex-party communications with Mr. Fletcher's wife and brother-in-law. Can you address that and ultimately make sure to talk about why that evidence, of which he did not have notice before Mr. Fletcher made his decision, is something other than cumulative?
Yes. Basically, in his testimony, for the first time, the deciding official revealed that he had relied on information and communications from his spouse, who was a nurse, and from his brother-in-law, who is a nurse practitioner. Basically, he said that those were his main advisors and the main people that he looked to and trusted to provide him with advice and information. These are individuals who are not employees of the Department of Defense or the Air Force. By relying on advice and information from these individuals and not providing that information or advice to Mr. Johnson, that information severely prejudiced this ultimate decision of deciding official.
What new information, though, did he receive in those communications, just following up on my colleague's question?
The new information, we're not really sure what new information he received. What he testified about was that he spoke to his wife, who's a nurse, and he spoke to his brother-in-law and about whether or not they believed that Mr. Johnson was being dishonest about accidentally taking his mother's pills in the pill pack, or, you know, whether or not what was the likelihood of the possibility of Mr. Johnson doing that. And I'm not sure what discussions they had, whether they were medical discussions regarding drug addiction, or whether they were discussions regarding, you know, the likelihood of a patient accidentally taking medicine. Basically, what Fletcher testified about was that he spoke to both his wife and his brother-in-law, and I believe his testimony was the chances of that happening were, you know, slim to none, I think was his testimony. So I'm not sure specifically what he spoke about, and Mr. Johnson never really became aware of what information, what research, what testimony that the deciding official Fletcher relied on from his his wife or from his brother-in-law regarding, I guess, the medical possibility or just the possibility in general of Mr. Johnson accidentally ingesting his mother's pill on a one-time occasion.
Ms. Martinez, this is Judge Chen.
Yes.
As I'm looking at Mr. Fletcher, the deciding official testimony, he, in talking about consulting his wife and brother-in-law,
yes,
he says, quote, "I just wanted to make sure I wasn't off." And then after speaking to them, they confirmed the likelihood of innocent ingestion was slim to none. Mm-hmm. And so one way to interpret this is that the deciding official had already reached his conclusions about this and believed that there wasn't an innocent ingestion of the oxycodone. And then, but nevertheless, he just wanted to do a last-second sanity check after he had reached his conclusion to, quote, make sure he wasn't off. Would that be something that would – how would that be fairly characterized as new information?
Well, it would be characterized as new information because I know that that's one part of the testimony, but I believe that he also testified that the main person that he looked to for advice was his spouse, you know, I guess on making any sort of decision. And so we don't know exactly what, you know, we don't know exactly what came, what information and advice came from the spouse or came from the brother. I hear what you're saying that he says, you know, he just went to, you know, he asked them and they confirmed, but I'm not sure that I'm not sure how many conversations he had with his brother-in-law and with his wife. I'm not sure what came from those conversations. And I'm not sure that he had already made up his mind, prior to speaking to both of those people. And I'm assuming that he spoke to the – I'm not sure when he spoke to him, if it was prior to the oral reply or following the oral reply, because, you know, at some point during – following the oral reply, he had requested a list of Mr. Johnson's medications and prescriptions, and I'm not sure what his verification process was or what his thought process was. That would be pure speculation. But my point is – I'm not sure whether or not he'd made up his mind and whether or not speaking to his spouse or his brother-in-law was a turning point or provided some additional information that, you know, sort of tipped the scales toward his decision to terminate Mr. Johnson.
Well, I guess the concern I have a little bit is that we're at a point now where you and us, the court, are speculating as to what really happened. And as I understand it, these questions you're raising now are not questions you explored with him during the hearing. Is that right?
Correct.
Did you make any request to depose the wife or the brother-in-law or anything like that?
I did not, Your Honor, because I did not.
Were you prevented from doing that?
I'm not sure the answer to that question. The arbitration, the information regarding the wife and the brother-in-law were uncovered at the arbitration, and that was brought forth to the arbitrator, the ex parte communications. I don't know that following the – I don't know that I would have been able to depose the wife and the brother-in-law following the close of the arbitration legally.
This is Judge Toronto. What do you think that the legal standard is when we are in the situation where we essentially have, what, eight or so lines of testimony making to look at, which has language that leaves pretty unclear the relevant questions, what Mr. Fletcher was thinking before he had the conversations, how many conversations, what the substance of the conversation were, et cetera. What, if anything, can you point us to identify what legal standard in the face of uncertainty governs whether this needs somehow to be redone?
Basically, we're looking at, whether or not, well, first off, Mr. Johnson was never charged with lack of candor. Lack of candor was never brought up in his charges at any point up until the arbitration. So Mr. Johnson was never even given the opportunity to respond to allegations of lack of candor. Or falsification.
I know that this seems to me to be changing the subject, but it is very okay. One of the okay. central subjects yes. of your brief. So I guess I'm having some trouble, and maybe you can help me understand. What daylight is there between talking about lack of candor on one hand and on the other? You gave me an account, an accidental ingestion account, and I need to decide whether to believe that or not. He knew that that was in fact the issue, because there was no dispute that he ingested the medication. He gave an account that said it was accidental, and the entire question on the underlying charge, not on the penalty, but on the underlying charge, was is the decision maker going to believe him or not? I'm having trouble seeing what the difference is in this case between lack of candor and what he was clearly on notice of as the charge.
Well, the difference here would be the application of the penalty. So just a pure accidental ingestion of an illicit drug or a drug for which someone does not have a prescription would not yield a penalty of automatic termination.
Right, but the underlying fact was whether the decision maker was going to believe the account of accidental ingestion. Whatever use then the decision maker was going to make of his conclusion on that. I don't believe him, and that affects both the charge and the penalty. So I'm not sure what he didn't have notice of.
Well, if you'd let if you would allow me to respond.
Please.
Basically, he didn't have notice ever that he was not believed. So Mr. Johnson went into the arbitration and went into this case thinking that he just needed to explain the fact that he had taken it and that there was a presumption that his superiors would believe that it was a one-time accident and something that would yield a lesser penalty as opposed to a lack of candor, which yields a termination penalty almost, right off the bat. And so I think there was an assumption that he was an honest person, he was a good employee, he was up for a promotion, and that his superiors would trust him to be an honest individual. Why would they believe that he was lying?
Is it your position that he was removed for only lack of candor or both lack of candor and drug use?
I believe he was removed for lack of candor only, not the drug use. Because if the Air Force and there's testimony that says that if it just would have been drug use, we would have offered him assistance. We would have offered him, a drug program.
Does the panel have any further questions at the moment? Okay, hearing none. We will restore your, I think you reserved 2 minutes of rebuttal time.
Yes,
and,
thank you.
We will hear from Mr. Jordan, I think.
Yes, thank you, Court. May it please the Court. Petitioner Jacob Johnson brings this appeal challenging the decision of arbitrator Thomas Cipolla, which found that the U.S. Air Force's decision to remove Mr. Johnson from his position as a civilian firefighter followed proper procedures, was rational, and backed by substantial evidence. Mr. Johnson was removed from his position because he tested positive for an illicit substance, oxycodone, during a routine random drug test. Mr. Johnson does not dispute that he ingested oxycodone or that the drug test result was flawed or otherwise an error. Mr. Johnson's sole defense offered before the agency and the arbitrator is that he innocently or accidentally ingested his mother's oxycodone pill in a one-time mix-up. Mr. Johnson's various arguments challenging the agency and the arbitrator's holdings can all be reduced to Mr. Johnson's disagreement with the agency's failure to credit his innocent ingestion theory. However, it is not the law that an agency's failure to credit the uncorroborated explanation of
the petitioner. This is Judge Chen speaking. Hello? Yes, I'm sorry to cut you off, but I have a question. Again, it's about the ex parte communications with the wife and the brother-in-law. If we were to conclude that that was, in fact, new information, new material information, and therefore a due process violation, what would be the result of that? Would this case have to go all the way back down to have a new deciding official consider the charge?
Thank you, Your Honor. So I think the testimony you pointed to earlier, I think, conveys that this was, quote, confirming information and under other precedent.
Well, I understand that's your argument, and of course I read your brief and saw all that. I'm just trying to understand what would be the consequences if we disagreed with you.
Sure. So I think, you know, that is one point. But under the Stone versus FDIC analysis, there are two other considerations.
I'm sorry. This is Judge Toronto. You have now twice not answered the question. Assume for purposes of this question that we think there's a due process violation. What is the remedy?
Sorry, I misunderstood. I thought it was just talking about the cumulative nature. The remedy would be could be to remand it back and have other consideration. But what I was trying to convey is that even if it is considered cumulative, that's
where?
Only one of the
three. I'm sorry, sir. Remand it back where to do what?
Another arbitration could occur. I'm not entirely sure in terms of what that would be.
Wouldn't there need to be a deciding official who considered this case without those ex parte communications?
So if it was remanded back and there was consideration by another deciding official, that might be something that the arbitrator, another arbitrator or the MSPB could decide. To be honest, I have not thought through exactly what the exact permutations of what that would be if that was the decision. But I think assuming that it is a due process violation and, you know, as we contend in our brief, you know, the cumulative aspect is one aspect of the Stone factors. And assuming after balancing all of them, it is decided there's a due process violation, I think some sort of remand of some sort would be warranted, perhaps to another deciding official who would not have that, or for there to be another arbitration in which those were presented. But as we state in our brief, we do not believe that this represents due process.
This is Judge Toronto. I want to actually continue on this remedy question. So in prior cases involving due process problems or even other kinds of procedural problems where it's perfectly clear that the deciding official cannot any longer be the decision maker, or that a new deciding official's decision is required, is the standard remedy to say the removal is reversed, job is back pay is awarded, and if you want to now initiate a new removal, go ahead, but the removal until now has been reversed, and there is a reinstatement with back pay until such time as there is a new removal. I want to understand what the ordinary course remedy is when there is a tainted removal decision.
Understood. This was not something that we had briefed. That could potentially be a potential remedy. I'm not sure if I would. I don't know if I can speak to whether or not the ordinary course of the normal remedy that can be considered. But based off of what you've told me, that sounds like something the court can consider, assuming it finds that this is representative of the due process violation for the reasons we contend in the brief. We contend is not.
So on that question, finally, to the merits of the due process question, why do you think that this seven or eight lines of testimony are not a basis for saying this has to be redone? If as far as we can tell, Mr. Fletcher went from a state of uncertainty to certainty. We're not quite sure how uncertain he was, but from uncertainty to certainty, and he did it on the basis of evidence that he obviously considered important in making that shift from uncertainty to certainty, citing their medical credentials. Why is that not enough to say that there was outside communication that mattered in the evidence, or may well have mattered in the evidence, of which Mr. Johnson was not made aware before the decision?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. So I think that testimony on supplemental page 19, where Lieutenant Colonel Fletcher says, quote, "I just wanted to make sure I wasn't off," and then he says that they, quote, "confirmed the likelihood." And so under the Stone versus FDIC factors, there's three factors. One, whether it's cumulative, whether the employee knew of the error and had a chance to respond to it, and then the undue pressure. And so I think, you know, looking at the second factor, you know, the fact that it is explicitly confirmatory, he already knew that he did not believe this. The proposing official, Mr. Raynard.
I'm sorry, I want to interrupt there. It seems to me that there's a intuitive difference between cumulative and confirmatory. If I have an intuition about something, but I'm not sure, and that's the reason I go and ask somebody else who I think has some insight into this, what they think about this, and that confirms my intuition, it can't be, can it, that scenario is one in which that evidence doesn't matter?
So I think two decisions of this court are on point here. One is the Blank versus Department of Army case, 247 Federal 3rd, 1225. And that case says that, quote, "when a deciding official initiates ex parte communication that only, quote, confirms or clarifies information already contained in the record, there's due process violations." Similarly, the Spencer versus OPM, 95 Federal Appendix, 352 says, "information contained in the agency statement of the case simply confirms information already in the record." Now, I do acknowledge that if you have five pieces of evidence and you have a sixth piece of evidence, that, you know, it certainly, you know, can make a prior position more robust than it was before. So similar to, you know, citing my brief, if I have a string cite.
So can you tell me what evidence did the slim to none commentary of Lieutenant Colonel Fletcher's wife and brother-in-law confirm?
So as this court previously indicated, the underlying inquiry here is whether or not the agency deciding official and then the arbitrator believe the innocent ingestion theory. If they did not believe that, then the idea that there's no nexus falls apart, and the idea that the punishment was unreasonable falls apart. And so Lieutenant Colonel Fletcher, the deciding official, had to decide, do I credit this, and credit is apart from this dishonesty, lack of candor part, which you can talk about later, but is this explanation credible? And he looked at various factors, considered the you know, the facial implausibility of this being a one-time incident of mixing up his mother's pills on the same day he happened to have a drug test, and then at the arbitration it confirmed that the pill sizes were different, and all this other evidence that further confirmed that at the arbitration. But the deciding official looked at it and said, this does not sound right. The proposing official also didn't believe that. And so, you know, simply the way this reads is sort of, you know, sort of dinner time. Oh, I have this dinner time talk where he just sort of, you know, raises this, and she sort of just confirms this underlying feeling that he already had. And so given that, I think it is cumulative or confirmed.
Judge Chen speaking. What if his testimony was stated more like, I was leaning towards not finding the innocent ingestion claim credible. I was leaning against agreeing with Johnson on that. But I wasn't completely sure of it, and I happened to know all of these medical professionals in my family, my wife and my brother-in-law, and because they deal with drug administration, drug treatment all the time, and lots of patients that need medications. And I wanted to check with what they thought. And they both told me that it didn't make any sense. And so that really put the nail in the coffin for Mr. Johnson. Because, you know, they are experts, unlike me. And so I felt a little uncertain about it. If that's what he had said, would that be new information in your view, in the government's view?
So if that was the case where he was, quote, leaning in one direction, I still think that that would be confirmatory information. Well, first of all, I think that is a hypothetical. The record is all we have. And based off of that, there's no indication other than opposing counsel's speculation, perhaps, to indicate that that's the fact. The testimony we have, which he could have potentially elicited through further examination, might have shown that, but it didn't. And
no, I understand that. You got to go with my hypothetical. And the hypothetical is that the deciding official was leaning one way, but he had not come to rest. He had not come to rest. He had some lingering doubts. He had some uncertainty. And so he wanted to consult these medical professionals in his family. Because he felt like they're much more experienced with this particular issue, and he could trust their judgment on this.
Yeah, that would certainly confirm his initial inclination. If it was elicited that he was, quote, you know, leaning towards that, that would imply that he was favored to contend.
Okay. Well, can you think of a hypothetical where the government would find that it is in fact new information to consult medical professionals?
I think one example was if he was inclined to completely credit his accidental ingestion theory and the consultation of his wife and brother-in-law upended that understanding and caused him to, you know, essentially introduce a new consideration that, you know, then caused the penalty. But I think what the record shows is that, you know, he was
inclined. So new information has to be, in your view, new information has to be somehow completely decisive information that turns the tide on the inquiry.
Yes, Your Honor.
Where does it say that in the case law?
So I think in looking at whether or not something is cumulative or confirmatory or not, I think if I may finish my point, I think if it changes the nature of the inquiry, it ceases to be simply confirmatory or cumulative, and the nature of that information is substantively different as a result of that. And unless there are further questions, I ask the court to affirm the arbitrator's decision.
Can I ask one quick question? Can't we conclude that family members have great influence over one another and therefore can exert undue pressure under Stone? Just wanted to get to that factor, too, before you sit down.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. So I think where that comes into play is whether or not the wife and brother-in-law had an interest in Mr. Johnson's case. And there's no indication that they had any relationship with him or even cared about the outcome of this. So they would not, exercise, I believe the Stone says, undue pressure upon an assigned official to rule in a, quote, particular manner. There's no evidence that they had any interest whatsoever regarding whether Mr. Johnson stayed in the service or did not.
You don't think that if they said that is preposterous, that he might feel some undue pressure not to come back the next night and say, you know what I did? I gave the guy a pass. I believed him, that they might say, are you crazy? Maybe this is a good reason for keeping the family out of your judicial decisions.
Just so that I can understand the hypothetical you propose, when you say preposterous, I think in terms of whether or not it, whether or not this represents an outrageous action on Mr. Johnson's part, I think.
No, on Mr. Fletcher's part, right? He consults with them. They say the scenario that Mr. Johnson has proposed is preposterous. Couldn't possibly be true. He then goes back to decide. Actually, I find it pretty plausible. You don't think he's under some pressure not to go back and answer the question? How did you decide the case? And that he doesn't want to say, I disagreed with you. I actually thought that the accidental ingestion account was plausible, and I credited it.
In your hypothetical, if the wife and brother-in-law had vociferously advocated for, vociferously advocated for a complete, assigning a degree of disapproval or a degree of a very strong reaction against that, I think that might come closer to ruling in a particular manner. But based off of the record evidence we have, it appears to just be a sort of sanity check on his already formed belief. And they simply said, yeah, that sounds right. And I think that's how the record reads. So I think in the hypotheticals that the court has posed today, I think that would certainly, make the decision a little bit more difficult. And I can see that's where the court is grappling with. But with the record we have, I think it clearly fits under the Stone factors as something that would not represent a due process violation and is why the court should affirm the arbitrator's decision on this matter.
I do, actually. I think the question arose earlier about whether Ms. Martinez could have secured additional discovery, maybe depositions of Lieutenant Colonel Fletcher's wife and brother-in-law to nail down what was said and therefore to assess whether the potential of what it was that Lieutenant Colonel Fletcher both heard and might have felt in terms of pressure. Do you have a view about whether that kind of discovery would in fact have been available when during the arbitration?
So the general approach that the deciding official and the arbitrator took was to be very accommodative of petitioners' attempts to, you know, secure deadlines and other sorts of things. So if petitioner had asked for a stay of the proceedings while she deposed or gathered more information on this, I have no reason to doubt that wouldn't be granted. I'm unsure of any legal basis where it would be unable to depose those individuals outside of them being outside subpoena power, which I have no reason to suspect that would be. So I don't know if that would be the case, and I have no reason to suspect that a deposition would be disallowed or otherwise prohibited. I have no reason to believe that.
Okay. Unless there are further questions from the panel, thank you for your argument, and we will have rebuttal time, I think 2 minutes, but let's say 3 minutes for Ms. Martinez.
Okay, thank you. Basically, the panel had asked what the remedy should be. And if you look at Stone, the remedy for ex parte, if there's a due process violation of ex parte communications, the remedy is to wholly reverse the agency's decision to terminate Mr. Johnson. Additionally, also there is some language in case law regarding the agency's, this court's ability to go ahead and just remand it back, for the agency to issue a new proposal.
What happens to the period before the new proposal between the earlier removal and the new proposal?
I mean, I think that Mr. Johnson would be reinstated, with back pay during that period of time. So, in theory, if the agency's decision to remove is reversed, then he should be reinstated with back pay. Basically, with regard to the judge's question regarding the undue pressure that Colonel Fletcher's wife may have put on him, Colonel Fletcher did testify when asking who his consultants were. He said, well, I look to my main consultant, who is my wife. And so I do believe that if you look at the Anderson's the Anderson subjective test, which is also listed in Stone versus FDIC, that he was unduly influenced by his wife, not only because she was a nurse, but because he did announce that that was his main consultant that he looked to. And this is somebody who is outside the agency and does, certainly family does exert undue influence, especially if Mr. Fletcher is testifying that this is his main consultant. Clearly he is going to be influenced by the statement of not only his wife, but also of a medical professional and also, his brother-in-law, who I assume is his wife's brother.
This is Judge Chen. Respond to the government's citation to Blank, a Federal Circuit opinion, which seems to state that mere confirmatory information is not really deemed to be new information?
Well, I don't believe this is confirmatory information because, first off, Colonel Fletcher never spoke to Mr. Johnson. Not one time during the entire process did he speak to Mr. Johnson or ask him what happened. So I don't believe it was confirmatory. I believe that it was exploratory and investigatory. He was exploring the possibilities and options and investigating.
But he knew that what he had heard what Mr. Johnson's account was, right? The innocent, the accidental ingestion account. Is that right?
I believe so.
And that's what the issue was, whether an undisputed ingestion was accidental or not, and he needed to decide whether the and had he heard that the account was accidental because of mix-up in his taking responsibility for arranging the medicines for his mother?
I'm not sure if he had heard that. I mean, I'm not sure what he heard. If you look at Colonel Fletcher's testimony, it's very disjointed. And it seems like he didn't look at the Douglas factors, and he basically just adopted what the proposing official, Renard, had stated. So I can't confirm that he knew exactly what was going on, or he was just adopting whatever was in the Douglas factor sheet that he reviewed.
Okay. If there are no further questions, I think I heard the bell ending the rebuttal time, and our thanks to both counsel, and the case is submitted.